This episode of the IT News Podcast is brought to you by Slack, the AI-powered platform for work that brings together your conversations, apps, and customers in the one place. To hear Slack's thoughts on how forward-thinking Australian leaders motivate and orchestrate their teams, whether they're face-to-face or far away, stay tuned to the end of this episode.
Hello and welcome to a brand new season of the IT News Podcast. Our first guest this year is Darren Farnham, the Chief Technology Officer of Australian broadcaster SBS. On the topic list is, of course, technology strategy, but also the broad operational remit of the technology organisation and the details of a 2.5-year content management system transformation.
I'm interested in the SBS technology strategy at a high level. Maybe if you could just talk a little bit to some of the key pillars and or the associated programs of work in those pillars. And I guess secondly to that, not to load up the question too much, but I'm also interested in the planning horizons that you look at, whether it's sort of a 3-year, a 5-year or more future looking perspective.
The way that we tend to think about it in technology, our strategy has to really underpin the overall SBS strategy. We tend to think about it in a 1 to 3 year type horizon. The environment that we're working in is rapidly moving. So I think to try and put a 5 to 7 year type horizon on this would be really quite difficult for us. So we're really thinking about what do we need to do in the next year and what do the subsequent sort of 2 to 3 years past that look like? And then to talk to the individual pillars that underpin that, I think we've got 5 that we really work across within technology here at SBS. 2 of them are more foundational and that really goes to making sure that we're thinking about our infrastructure, whether we're on-prem or whether we're in the cloud. We tend to take a blended approach with considering the systems and where our needs are. And then we wrap around that a cybersecurity lens clearly with the current climate. We need to consider all of our systems and best practice in making sure that we're trying to protect both the data that we hold internally, but also our systems from a cyber perspective. And then we've really got some pillars that then underpin our growth and what we see is enhancements to the strategy. And so that's really around us building out from a digital perspective. We talked about on demand. We also have a CMS program of work and a whole bunch of websites and applications that we're ideating on there to continue to try and make sure that we're best in breed for our audiences. And then we're also underpinning that with data at the heart of our decision making so that when we're making key decisions, we're really looking at what is the data telling us, how people are interacting with us. We're using both data and feedback from the apps and from the interactions with our audiences, but also making sure that we're talking to our audiences as well through panels and asking them around what are the features and enhancements and things that are going to make a real difference to what we're delivering to them. And then finally, we're really thinking about the whole audience experience, which really needs to sit within the technology strategy because here at SBS, the team is just not a typical ICT type technology team that thinks about servers and infrastructure and networks. We also have a large operational part to the portfolio as well. So we have studio productions, thinking about making TV production, radio production. We also have the physical assets of the building and how we make sure that we run the facility. So really putting the audience at the centre of our strategies is critically important because it's not just around how do we make the tech work and how do we make sure that we're really fit for purpose there. It's also around how are we making sure that our audiences are getting what they need and our internal clients, the people that are making the content in our TV online, radio or news divisions, are getting everything they need from us.
You've partially answered a question there for me, which was around the structure of the operation that sits under your guys' CTO. But maybe you could just give me a sense, I guess, of that. So you mentioned there it's not just a traditional sort of ICT team. There's a lot of different operational aspects as well. Do you want to just give me a bit of a sense of how big the team is, how broad that cross-section of responsibility is? And I guess particularly it'd be good to get a breakdown of how many are in that more traditional ICT lens versus outside of it.
Well, we've got 240 ongoing employees that sit within the technology division, if you want to call it that. And as I said, yes, ICT systems, those kind of typical functions are all there. But we also have a larger infrastructure that also needs to underpin the media and production of media that happens within SBS. It's really interesting because we have people that literally work in a team that think about styling our presenters, hair and makeup, those kind of things that don't typically sit within a CTO type portfolio. So you have a broad division that's looking at that. And so we're looking at also how do we bring in casuals and freelance elasticity into our production teams. So, for example, we would have in any given time all of the casual staff that we bring in that really allow us to be able to do a new season of The Cook-Up with Adam Lior, or allow us to do a new season of Mastermind that we produce in our studios here at SBS. So the breakup, typically, I think on an ongoing basis, we've probably got a 50% of our team are working on your typical IT business type processes. And then the same again, thinking about our production needs and the day-to-day operation of the media part of the business.
It probably makes sense just to expand on the pillars in those two specific areas you talked about, which were the foundational areas and the growth areas. So just firstly, on the foundational areas, do you want to just give us a sense of what infrastructure looks like and what some of the key platforms look like at SBS? So you mentioned that you have a blended approach in terms of on-prem and cloud-based infrastructure, and you're wrapping a cybersecurity lens around all of that stuff. But it'd be useful just to, I guess, understand a little bit more about how the cloud infrastructure looks like, how the on-prem infrastructure looks like, and what some of the key systems are that are really used day-to-day at SBS.
Happy to do that. Typically, the way that we've structured is we've got a migration program of work looking at your typical ICT requirements and looking at where does it make sense for those to be. And those typically, for a lot of our systems, will be cloud-based. We use Amazon Web Services, like a lot of others, and use automated processes to obviously provide our typical patching and upgrades of that environment. We also have a lot of media production going on. So we have a media asset management system that allows us to be able to ingest, share, edit, and publish content. And for us, having that on-prem is vitally important because we transact on it heavily. So moving it to the cloud and then having to think about ingress and egress costs, it doesn't really make a lot of sense. It's time critical and we really need it to be at the heart of the organization and how we operate, where some of the other products can typically sit in a cloud-based environment. So that's typically the way we think about it. We think about it from what makes sense from a business perspective, and then also think about the resources and costs around making sure that we're fit for purpose in that space.
I guess it makes sense to talk more in detail about some of the growth elements, and particularly the first one around digital and CMS and websites. It's something that we wanted to focus on a little bit in this conversation. I'm assuming an enormous amount of technology work that's been going on over some period of time.
We've been working very closely with our editorial and product teams to really think about, as I mentioned before, what is the feedback we're getting from our audiences? What does best in class look like? And how do we make sure that we're really honing in on the things that are going to make a difference for the audience and put them at the center of our thinking? Clearly, you have to build the right pipelines. You have to make sure that you've got your tech in and those requirements all scaled and ready to go. But for us, it was really around thinking about how do we decouple those two? So thinking about what does the back-end CMS need to look like? How do we really make sure that that's fit for purpose? And then having an abstracted layer on the front end of the websites that allows us to really have design elements that allow us to reskin and build something once and use it for many different properties across SBS. We started in February 2021 by putting out a brand new presence for our news team. And then we worked through sport and then also through our NITV and Indigenous content space. We also work through using 63 different languages for our audio, language and content teams, our typical teams that are working very closely with community around how we present our language content. And then the cherry on top, I guess, was pulling all of that work together and presenting it through sbs.com.au. It was certainly a proud moment for the team, and having an amazing team, a team that really works so closely with the business, has really enabled us to get this large amount of work done.
So it might be tracing a little bit back to what might be ancient history on the program itself, but I wondered if you could just go back to how this all started and what really kicked off the work to upgrade all the digital backend. Was changing consumption habits the driver, or was there something else that was driving the program even before those trends started to occur?
There was multiple drivers. We knew that we had a need to overhaul the websites and the customer-facing presence. But if you look at the underlying tech, it was around about 10 years old, so very ancient in regards to modern techniques and technical capacity. But I think the really important thing for us was that we had individual instances of CMSs that were built in Drupal, and the team internally had built those out across up to 17 different platforms. And so they all had an individual CMS. And what we found was it was just from a resource perspective, as requirements grew and each of those teams wanted to move with the audience, that we just weren't in the business of building CMSs. And that often one or two of those particular platforms would get some work done and they would enhance and improve the outcome for those particular websites. Then others would start to fall behind. And so we really try to take a look back and think about it from a holistic point of view, thinking, what is it that SBS really needs? And that was a single CMS to allow us to showcase content, to allow teams to be able to move content between various presences that really are forward-facing and audience-facing, and for us to decouple the need for us to continually invest in building in CMSs and have that lag that comes with having 17 individual instances.
Being in media also, I know the importance of a good CMS and what it brings to workflows and general production. And I can imagine as well in the example that you've just mentioned there, where if you had 17 of them running concurrently and you create an enhancement in one, then others within the group would see that and potentially want it replicated in their own, which might have caused some duplication issues of the workload for the technology team.
Certainly, and even just patching and updates and all of the security features that you need to continue to do, having to do those on 17 different sites, it just duplicates. You end up with just a huge amount of work and a big backlog of, as you say, the enhancements and opportunities that features bring. So that's why we really wanted to look differently at how we moved forward and didn't want to just replicate what had been done before. It served us really well in the early stages, embryonic stages of our digital presence, but really looking at how do we want to set ourselves up for the next 3-year horizon and beyond, it was finding a CMS that would really help us with language and have some production workflows, and so that you've got a roadmap from a vendor that you're moving with other like-minded media organizations down a path as well. So not all of the heavy lifting has to be done internally by the SBS team, but we can actually benefit from being on a roadmap with others.
And was there a reason why the organization had evolved to have all these different instances of CMSs? Obviously, this is kind of going before your time at the organization, but what was the reason for that path of evolution?
As you say, I wasn't here at SBS at the time, but I think typically a lot of organizations probably do this, is that you end up with organic growth. So it starts off setting up a particular site and then that starts to grow and then another site is spawned. And because there was no thought of how do we build out a single CMS and an abstracted layer of what the user experience looks like, you end up with this organic growth. So I don't think anybody originally thought on a whiteboard, let's build 17 of these. I think it probably started off with let's build 3 or 4. And then over time and growth of digital consumption and audience requirements and people really wanting to move and continue to take our content through digital experience, that it was really an organic path rather than a strategy per se.
When you approach consolidating 17 CMSs down to one, how do you go about that? Because I imagine although there were similarities across them, and particularly in their underpinnings with Drupal, there were probably a lot of differences as well. So how do you bring all those teams together and consolidate all of those requirements into one single CMS that everyone's going to be happy with?
It was one of the biggest concerns, I think, from all of the team when we first started, was obviously in each one of those individual instances in the previous CMSs, they had their own environment set up specifically for a certain team, and that team had operated that way for a lengthy period of time. So one of the things we really needed to do was get buy-in right across the whole organization from the top down and thinking about how did we want to set ourselves up to make sure that we weren't continuing to have these bottlenecks and these challenges with these environments. And so we brought the teams together, we set up champions in those teams, and we sat down and said, what does good really look like for us? Thinking about workflow, thinking about the base level requirements. And we built out a series of both technical requirements, but also the sort of requirements that are needed for editorial teams, the workflows, and what is it we needed to do to try and make sure that we could continue to grow consumption, grow the opportunity to feature the content that we needed to get to our audiences, but without continuing to add to a big resource pool to be able to make that happen. And then from there, we really went out, looked at what was in the market from those requirements. We started off with about 16 CMSs that we looked at. We looked at a list of criteria that included things like multilingual support that's so important for us here at SBS, considering our charter, our mission, and what we're trying to achieve every single day. But then also the multi-site support off that. So we really wanted to hone in on a solution that could give us that one CMS at the back end and multiple presences at the front end, so we can continue to have different brands and different opportunities for people to interact with us. We wanted a headless API-driven architecture so that we could have that separation, and we really wanted to make sure that it was also a cloud-based offering with really good SSO support for security and the like as well. So from there, we whittled the list down. We got down to a list of 4 promising candidates and went through a proposal situation with each of those, and then went out to a more formal RFP and eventually ended up with Brightspot, who was the vendor that we selected. And that solution's really worked extremely well for us, and their power of being able to deal with language was so important to us. I think they were established in about 2012, so they've been around 10 years, and they've got some other major publishing clients as well. So for us, both the architecture, the design, the opportunity to get onto the roadmap and the internal publishing workflows meant that they were a really good option for us to take forward and to make sure that we got the needs together. that's the first piece of the puzzle, is trying to select what that is. I think going back to your original question, it's then what about the organisational change, and how do we make sure that we're not just putting a bunch of shiny new tech in around the business? We really needed the rest of the editorial teams, those people that are the digital teams that work every day, to be excited and see the opportunity that came out of the new tech rather than be something that's sort of enforced upon them.
Do you want to talk a little bit about, once you'd made that selection, how you went about remapping the workflows across from the existing CMSs into this new consolidated CMS? And I guess as a second part to that question, what key differences were in the new platform that perhaps weren't available in the previous side, which have really been embraced by some of the teams out in the organization?
One of the things we tried to work out was how could we decant this down into something that allows us to phase the implementation. Trying to big bang the change would have been impossible for us to do. So we realized fairly quickly that we needed to come up with a phased approach to this work. And it was going to take us a couple of years to get from one end of that plan to the other. It was agile delivery. You'd expect digital team to work in that way. But we really needed to keep an eye on also making sure that we didn't just have this continuous ideation. We needed to make sure that we could actually get to an outcome. And so we sat down and pulled together, as I said before, some champions that would work in each of those editorial teams. And we sat down and built out a POC environment for them. We enabled some early migration of content. We really sat down and worked with our tech BA and change manager to go through and have a look at all the stage gates that we needed to have with the editorial process. The great thing about the new interface as well is that it comes such a long way from what the team were previously using. So some of the things I could share with you, for example, are a live preview function. It makes a load of sense, but just being able to actually make some changes within the CMS and have a look at a live preview of what that's going to look like when you publish it before you get to publishing stage, that was something that we couldn't do before. Now, it sounds like a fairly simple requirement, but certainly not something that we had. So we did see a big uptake of those teams once we got to actually training them. And an example is the first website that we went live with was News and Current Affairs. And we had about 100 editorial staff that we needed to train. So we couldn't do that in a room with 100 people. We needed to break that down. We still had all of our day-to-day requirements. So it was working out a change in comms plan, a training plan, having really good change materials in there as well, so that teams could go through the training and then go away and be able to work in a UAT environment that was fully populated with data so that they could practice everything before we actually made the change. So all of those things are really important. And then once we got that on, the biggest problem we had was that then all of the rest of the business saw a shiny new user experience, a great new front end, this production environment, and they almost wanted to go straight away overnight. So it was good to have the rest of the editorial teams excited about wanting to come onto the new platform rather than being nervous about the fact that they were going to have to move and the usual change fatigue that can come along.
So over what period of time did you phase that implementational rollout across the organisation?
From go to where the whole program was about 2.5 years, we did the phased move of each of the particular websites through. And we did have to pause as well because we had the FIFA World Cup as well. One of the things we decided to do was that we put change control in. We didn't want to be making a bunch of changes in live environments or having a lot of the team focus on the change to certain aspects of this tech while we had such an important event going on for us. So it's really taken us that amount of time to do it. But with the phased approach and the ability for us to be able to migrate each one of those individual Drupal instances across and think about it in that phased approach allowed us to be able to pick up a bunch of learning along the way as well, so that we were seeing what was working, what bugs might have come along. There's always some of those when you make these change with this level of change, really useful to be able to put that into the thinking and make sure that you don't continue to do that through the program of work.
As a journalist, a big feature of CMSs, and especially for us web native folk, is the analytics that is in the CMSs. I really couldn't live without that kind of analytics when we're writing stories, but also when we're trying to analyze the performance of traffic and understand just what's going on with the sites. Do you want to talk a little bit about that side of the CMS for you as well? But I guess also how that might broadly play into the strategic pillar that you outlined, which was around the use of data for decision making and also, I guess, for personalization of content as well.
I think analytics has always been important and a great tool. As you say, it's not something new, but one of the things that we really talked about at the start of this program was making sure that the analytics were at the heart of the design and that we wouldn't actually move into a launch phase unless we'd really thoroughly thought about making sure that the analytics were not only in place, but they were delivering us insights and things that were actually going to help our teams be able to understand what's working, and what we might want to change along the way. So it was very much at the heart of the planning. One of the things that we've done along the way is also done a bunch of work around doing some A/B testing so that we can look at placement of articles and related content on our websites and seeing what does one cohort think about when we place something within the website design versus another, and be able to compare and contrast. And that allows us to hypothesize around our build moving forward. So we're using some of the Adobe products there just to help us with driving out some of the insights that we can get from that. And I guess putting it back into an overall perspective, because of the work that we've done, we've seen some significant improvements in what we're seeing from the interaction with our audiences on that work as well. I think that tells you that the analytics that we put in there are not only giving us better visibility, but it's also allowing us to make sure that we're improving what we're doing and hopefully making the audiences more excited to come back and continue to consume the content that we're giving them.
And just on the audience experience side of things, which was the final pillar that you mentioned in the strategy, did you want to talk a little bit about the audience experience side of things, both from a CMS perspective, but also more broadly?
Sure, and we're certainly using Adobe across the board. Their MarTech stack's been really useful for us. We've implemented their CDP product as well. So it gives us much better visibility around how consumers are actually consuming content right across all the SBS platforms. And that really helps us with both allowing our sales team to use that data to help with monetization, but more importantly for us to also think about how do we personalize and improve the experience when people come and actually interact with us. So if we can understand more around how people are interacting, then we can use that to personalize their experience when they get there. One of the key pieces of work as part of that strategy is us working on a direct piece of work around on-demand, so that when you get the on-demand platform through your login, we start to get a much better understanding about the onward user journey and for us to be able to make sure that we're capitalizing on the way to give you the content that you are actually looking for without you having to continually go through and search, because search and user fatigue, when people have many different applications that they might be consuming media from, is something that we're acutely aware of, and we see that there's a big opportunity for us to continue to improve that space.
Welcome to this special IT News discussion with Slack, the AI-powered home of work platform to keep your teams connected and engaged. I'm Nate Cochran, contributing editor for IT News and your host today. Leading teams, whether you're face-to-face, in the office, or far away, separated by streets, suburbs, states, or even time zones, has never been more challenging. So if you're looking for ways to link and enthuse your teams while maintaining your own sanity, you're in the right place. Joining us to elevate these topics is Derek Laney, Slack Technology Evangelist. Welcome to the podcast, Derek.
Hey, Nate. Thanks for having me.
First of all, for those who don't know what Slack is or are new to this topic, tell us a little bit about the platform.
Slack is the place where you get work done. It brings all of your people, your data, and artificial intelligence together in a way that makes people more productive. Whether you are preparing a plane for departure or you're building some of the world's most sophisticated software products, you can use Slack to boost productivity and get more work done.
A foundational component of boosting productivity, though, is how well a leader motivates their teams, which means exercising empathy while staying on mission. But today's work styles demand new tools. Derek, what do our listeners need to elevate the job satisfaction and productivity of their teams?
Nate, there's a whole bunch of things that we've been researching around work, as well as how new tools like artificial intelligence are changing the shape of work as complex work is starting to become more of our everyday. The simple things are being automated, and what's left tends to involve a lot more human collaboration. It involves going across a number of systems to bring information together. The simple stuff is being automated, which is making what's left much more complicated.
Derek, you raise a good point regarding what's left for us to do after everything else is automated. So how are modern leaders deploying AI today?
A great example is McLeod Cranes, a crane operator in New Zealand. They're using artificial intelligence inside Slack to be a virtual team member. It's a health and safety officer. It reviews all of their reports and provides recommendations to them proactively, taking a process that was 2 days to being done under a minute. And for employees, they know that leaders are not just looking to these tools to get more done without them. They're looking at how they can use the human capital within their organization and these tools in combination to get better outcomes. That's the win-win that's going to get people engaged in the use of AI.
As a worker, having confidence that you'll at least be acknowledged for the value you bring is surely the first step, Derek. So what do leaders need to know to get the best from them?
Great relationships involve both trust and accountability. So teams feel more supported by managers who trust that they're accountable for delivery. Workers who can deliver outcomes trust they'll be credited its value. Trust creates speed and flexibility. Leaders need to look less at the inputs and more at the outcomes of a worker to understand their value. A big part of that is making it safe to work in the open. So the key capability of leaders, secondly, is making a safe environment, enabling all employees to feel comfortable working in this type of environment where they're more likely to be sharing what's happening in real time before they understand the outcome. Leaders can react much more quickly and be more adaptive. But to do that, we need to build psychological safety. And that's a key capability that we see leaders developing. Thirdly, I'd say we need to value the capture of learning, not only the end of the road. So as teams increase their autonomy, we're giving them the ability to start experiment, to try out new things, but we want them to capture what they learn and share it with others. More likely, they'll be using new tools, things like artificial intelligence. Just in the last 6 months, our Slack research shows that usage has gone from about 1 in 5 to 1 in 4, but the exact ways of working are still being worked out. Progress and learning is one of the key things that leaders can do to keep this type of environment active in their teams. And fourthly, I'd say it's about understanding different work styles. These range from the person who loves to get answers themselves, someone like a detective mindset, to those that are the great sharers of information, the expressionists, who are visual communicators that create the culture of your team, and understanding which styles of work are required for your project and how to get a balance among the team is a big part of what being a leader is about. And then the last thing I would say is supporting the team as humans first. Leaders need to build experience using a broad palette of work tools to enable them to be successful in more situations. Right now here in Australia is the conversation around the right to switch off, because we're leaning too much on synchronous tools, being together and working something through or requiring an instant response rather than thinking about more efficient ways, regardless of whether we're available in that moment.
You lead us to the need for diversity and inclusion in our teams. And as many of our listeners are in a global war for talent, how can they leverage more diversity within their teams to deliver superior outcomes?
Diversity and inclusion is about different ways of approaching a problem. So as we hire in a more diverse way, we build a broader palette. Then tools like Slack enable us to leverage that human capital when we need it in our teams.
It's a maxim of top leaders that employees are their top priority, because happy staff create happy customers and that delivers business success. In what ways is Slack making employees happier?
Our research found that 9 in 10 workers saying feeling happy and engaged at work is a key driver of productivity. Alarmingly, a huge amount of what employees spend their time doing, almost a third of their time, is something called performative work, which is, it's not focusing on getting the outcome. A great leader understands how to minimize the effort that employees need to take in these sorts of extracurricular tasks to help them stay focused on the outcome.
So if a leader's keen to level up their own performance, how do they get started with Slack?
Rather than hold that meeting, bring all the information together in a channel, let people read and understand first, maybe contribute more ideas. Brain writing, where we write our ideas down first before we start talking about them openly, tends to generate more creativity. The information is not about swivel chairing between a million different systems. It's all in the channel where the people are as well. Then layer these new AI tools on top of that. You can do things like catch up faster using the AI to tell you what's been going on since you last looked, summarize project updates or past history. And then you build this real-time knowledge base for your organization that's then searchable by AI. You can ask real questions. The AI will read for you and then synthesize for you the answer to your questions. Just think about how much more productivity tools like that will give to you and also to your teams.
And for anyone who wants to onboard with Slack, what's the process?
You can go to slack.com and sign up for free to get started, and then talk to us about what's the best fit for making it work in your organization.
That was Derek Laney, Slack's technology evangelist, sharing his tips for how to be a better leader, whether your team is in the office or far apart. Listen out for our next Slack chat when we learn how AI-powered safety officers overhauled a crane operator's workplace incident management and reporting. And to catch up on podcasts with your tech and business peers, head to itnews.com.au and click on the podcast tab at the top. I've been Nate Cochrane. Thanks for listening.